This is Mark Lane.
This is Robert Groden.
This is Dick Russell.
This is Jim Mars.
This is Lisa Pease.
This is Dr. David Mantic.
This is Cyril Weck.
This is Jim DiEugenio.
This is Joan Mellon.
This is David Lifton.
This is Jerry Polakoff.
This is Gary Shaw.
This is Bill Kelly.
This is Greg Burnham.
This is Gerald McKnight.
This is Sherry Feaster.
This is Joseph McBride.
This is Bill Davey.
This is Dave Ratcliffe.
This is David Talbot.
This is Doug Horn.
This is Walt Brown.
This is John Barber.
This is Judge Joe Brown.
This is Bill Pepper.
This is Richard Belzer.
This is Oliver Stone.
This is Governor Jesse Ventura, and you're listening to Black Op Radio.
Video computers online. Archiving 44K. Initiate sequence.
T-minus 30 seconds. T-minus 25 seconds. T-minus 20 seconds.
Phone lines are go.
T-minus 15 seconds. T-minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. Satellite uplink verified.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leno Sanic.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. This is your host, Len Osanek. Today, we're speaking to researcher, author, Vince Palamara. Hello, Vince.
Oh, hello, Len. Thanks for having me back on. Love the show, and hello to all your listeners. Appreciate it.
Great. Well, there was a conference in Dallas. Actually, there was a couple of conferences there and things going on. I didn't get to go. I wanted to ask you, you were there, for your impressions of what was going on and you know, the state of research, and, you know, maybe talk about your presentation.
Sure. Well, I could just tell you in a thumbnail, and I'll get into more detail, but first impressions were my wife and I, we both had a great time. We really did. It was very educational. It was really nice to see so many familiar faces again and meet some new ones. And there's always a part of me that's always skeptical that time is our enemy and, you know, eventually people are going to lose interest or, you know, like when it went from the 20th to the 21st century, then 9/11 and then, you know, everything else and subsequent presidencies and so on and so forth. You say to yourself, okay, is it going to get to the point where people are going to like, it's going to dim a little bit? Well, may or may not be happening with the general public. I don't know, but I could tell you one thing. It was a very healthy, alive interest. The spark that was in Dallas was the same that I felt 20 some years ago. And that was just amazing. I'd say at Trine Days Conference, Trine Days the publisher, and yes, some people call it the Judith Baker Conference, but most people viewed it as the Trine Day Conference because the fact is there was many Trine Day authors speaking there, and I'm one of them. I'd say there was roughly about 150 people there, very enthusiastic, and all the presentations were very well attended. And on the other side, I admit I didn't go to Kappa. No offense, I was invited to the one and I wasn't invited to the other. But Kappa, for people who don't know, it used to be COPA. But Lancer, what they did is they melted into COPA and become Kappa. So that was that. And I heard nothing but good things about that because they actually shared some speakers. Dr. Cyril Weck spoke at both. But as far as the conference I did go to, but like I said, secondhand information, that conference went really well. And I heard from a couple of reliable sources, they had about an attendance of about 150. And while there was some overlap, there was a healthy amount of people that didn't go to one or the other. And in Dealey Plaza itself, because I was there November 21st through and including November 24th, including for the anniversary, of course, the attendance was amazing, and this is for non-conference people as well as conference people. There was a few hundred people there, really enthusiastic. And the amazing thing was, obviously, you know, we know the obligatory, the conferences are all filmed. Kappa was filmed, and, you know, the Trine Day Conference was filmed. Well, a nice little wrinkle was the Japanese news crews, it was a major Japanese news station was there filming at the Trine Day Conference. I don't know if they did it at CAP or not, but they were there filming at length for a documentary that's going to be coming out. And just judging by the faces of the Japanese film crew, they're really interested in this. So it's amazing. I can tell you the camera person at the Trine Day conference was Randy Benson of the Searchers fame. Everybody knows the Searchers documentary. But Len, I can tell you what, just as far as level of enthusiasm and how inspiring it was really amazing. As good, if not better, and I could say a lot better than some conferences I've been to. In fact, even just the last time I was in Dallas was 2016, and it was decent, but I can honestly say this knocked it out of the park. And on a personal note, this was definitely the best presentation I ever gave. I had 45 minutes, and it was audio-visual tour de force. You know, I made the mistake last time of going up there and, like, Evelyn Woods speed reading and just going through, like, a script, and I'm not good at that. The best thing for me to do is talk off the cuff because I know the material like the back of my hand, and I like to have audio-visuals. I think it makes it more exciting for the audience because no matter how you think you are as a speaker, I think people sort of tune you out a little bit as you go on if it's just a person behind a lectern. But yeah, from a personal standpoint, that was great. I won an award there too. It was really nice. And if you want, I can go through some individual speakers that were there, any other individual. But the overall impression was just very inspiring. This late date, you know, 56 years later, the torch still burns for a lot of people, a lot of interesting things. Yeah.
Well, it sounds very encouraging. You didn't run across any animosity then between the two different groups? There was no battles on the grassy knoll?
No, actually, I'll be honest with you. You know, there's some people, and we can speak freely about this point. You know, obviously, it's not a secret that there's people that don't have a lot of love lost for Judith Baker, but she also has a lot of fans, too. And I told people, and I was telling people online about this, is that if you remember, 20-some years ago, JFK Lancer / Deborah Conway and her old partner Tom Jones is no longer there. There was a lot of people casting aspersions, were very wary of them, that they came out of nowhere, and what was their story, and some people made accusations. Sound familiar? Well, 20 years later, that's what we're getting. And, you know, I'm not going to go into whether there's any truth to it or not. I can just tell this, but for anybody out there who might say to yourself, Vince, come on, why did you go to the Trine Day / Judith conference besides the fact I was invited? Well, I'm a Trine Day author. That's number one. I spoke to other Trine Day authors, and a lot of people you could tell were really trying to remain neutral, not one side or another. They were there for John F. Kennedy's memory. They were there for the assassination. They were there for, you know, their personal research. This was a venue. I mean, quite frankly, the mainstream media has totally blocked us out. You know, there's not too many venues, and, you know, there might be billions of people on this planet. There's basically two conferences in America, and there's one in the UK. So it's basically choose one or the other, and that's it. And you're going to, obviously, you know, just human nature, you're going to get people against Kappa, you're going to get people against, you know, the Trine Day / Judith conference. But I will say on a positive note, there was no opening animosity. There was people intermingled on the grassy knoll, you know, in Dealey Plaza there for the ceremony up there near the pergola. And everybody was very nice. In fact, I even saw some intermingling in a very positive way, handshakes and hugs and whatnot. And so I think that, you know, there might be people more weary than they are outright hostile, because no matter what you can say, what you might think about Judith Baker, she's a very nice woman. And I'll say one thing. I think there's no doubt she definitely worked for Oswald, and there's no doubt that her conferences are doing good. I mean, she's not exactly making money on these things. I mean, you're talking, you know, a lot of people have travel and expenses and the overhead to carry. And I can tell you one thing I saw firsthand. They had a little auction at the end of the conference just to raise money to make sure this conference can go on again. And the people that were bidding were conference people. It wasn't like, oh, these are strangers, they're getting money from strangers. Now they're getting money from fellow conference goers who want to see us going. So they're pulling out their wallet to, like, raise money, and they were selling, like, old heirlooms and Penn Jones items and classic books and DVDs. So the money went back into the conference. So it might be break even, it might be a little more. I don't know. I can't speak to that. But I could just say there was a really nice liberal camaraderie, very pleasant surprise between the groups, no open hostility. I even saw some nice congeniality. And again, very pleasant surprise. Now, apart from the conference goers, I saw a lot of just regular strangers, John Q. citizens there with their, you know, wife and their kids and sons and daughters and that. It was just amazing. All ethnic groups, you know, Asian and, you know, everything. Indian, people from India, I said, or Japan, people from China, African American, God bless everybody. And the feeling was just amazing. You'd see everybody veering at the, you know, at the grassy knoll and taking photos and videos, and everyone going nuts with that and taking photos of the Texas Gold Depository. You could overhear people talk about theories and what they believed or what they knew. So that, in that respect, was just very encouraging. And again, you know, I went into this basically like, well, I'm presenting, I was invited, you know, Chris Milligan, my publisher, invited me, and, you know, make the best of it. But I'm always a little bit in the back of my mind, like I said earlier, a little bit skeptical, thinking, well, the time is marching on. And then I realized something. We had little huddles of groups. And, you know, you think about it. When you really, really dawns on you, I mean, there's still heavy interest in World War II, World War I, the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln, on and on and on. Now, it is 56 years ago, but there's still millions of people that remember John F. Kennedy. He's alive through the countless audio visual heirlooms out there, videos and photos and whatnot. I mean, it, just in the 10 years, I think I mentioned this in a previous show, Len, that just in the last 7 to 10 years, there's been thousands of photos and hundreds of videos and films that were never available before that time. So this digital age, so much has been released. The JFK Library has released thousands of photos that were never available before. So we are discovering new information. So it's like a two-part thing. You know, you have the public that's seeing these images and just amazing, these color images of a handsome president, and also seeing, you know, assassination-related items. But it wasn't like these, all these items were available for decades. No, a lot of this stuff is new. So when people out there say, oh, okay, what's new? Time marches on. Well, besides some amazing books and some really riveting presentations, beyond that, you have a really a wealth of audiovisual material that's only been available, again, in the last 7 to 10 years. And there's still more to come. In fact, all of John F. Kennedy's lengthy press conferences, they are not available, you know, other than little bits and pieces, sometimes of terrible quality, sometimes of okay quality, but they're just little bits and pieces. And the JFK Library could release them, and that's a treasure trove of information because people have so much fond memories of his press conferences. And again, so much of that is, you know, not available. If you want to, at this point, Len, I can go into a little more specifics on the conference I did attend. If you want, I can tell you about that.
Sure. Well, great summary. Thank you. Thank you very much for the summary. I was more interested in what you had to present, and if you want to give a summation of your presentation.
Oh, sure, yeah. Okay, like I said before, this one was a real audio-visual tour de force. I worked literally weeks, and you could argue months on it, because I would, you know, go back and forth on it and, you know, update it through the months, because I really wanted to make this good. So I had, like, basically almost a year to work on it. It was a PowerPoint presentation, and again, I had video clips, and what I want to do is demonstrate. It's one thing for people, I'm an author of 4 books, and, you know, you can read, but it's kind of like making an analogy like the JFK movie. You know, all those books, and on, with all due respect, all those authors through the years did not have the impact of an audiovisual presentation. So when I got up there, I think it really hit home. Well, I know it hit home. From the reaction I got was very positive, to put it mildly, from the audience. And again, what I did is I showed that in Dallas, President Kennedy's security was terrible, and it wasn't just an isolated, or, you know, it was an isolated thing. It wasn't like, oh, you know, President Kennedy had terrible security before. No, it showed that Dallas was different. And what I did is I compared to every, I have a treasure trove of, it took many years to find all these motorcade photos and films. So what I did was I demonstrated, for example, I started out showing many trips where the press photographers, still in motion photographers, were in front of the limousine filming. Now, while that's not strictly a security matter per se, well, there's all those professional eye and ear witnesses, feet away from the limousine, filming in front, professional film, sometimes even live TV streams. We wouldn't need amateurs like Abraham Zapruder, who was there on a fluke, and Orville Nix, and so on and so forth. We would have had so many more witnesses in filming and taking photos. And again, a lot of times there was even, I played some live television feeds. It really amazed people that, wow. And then it ended up in Dallas. The contrast was, not only was the flatbed trucks not there, well, there was press photographers that said it was canceled at the last minute. Who canceled it? The Secret Service. Second thing was, I showed about how many times, the motorcade, specifically John F. Kennedy's limousine, was flanked by many motorcycles, at least six to nine on each side, and often bracketing the car like in a diamond formation, and many others all around the motorcade and the cars before and after. Well, as we know, and I showed, like I said, various trips before, in fact, countless trips before, all the way from 61 up to including 63, and then you get to Dallas, and I always contrast in Dallas, not only was only just 4 motorcycles, they were pushed behind the rear wheels, and this was done by the Secret Service. And they claimed that Kennedy didn't like all that noise, and that's why they moved it. But yet, when Lawson testified before the Warren Commission under oath, he said, well, under this instance, there wasn't a specific order from the president. This is my understanding. He had like all that, you know, noise, but he didn't mind the noise the previous morning, the previous day, the previous trips, et cetera, et cetera. So that was quite a contrast. You could just tell by the reaction of the crowd. People were like, wow, the gasps and so on and so forth. Third thing was an important issue I brought up years ago was about agents' proximity or lack thereof to the limousine itself. And I showed a lot of trips in the past, including the previous one in Florida 4 days before, where agents were riding on the rear of the car. The two, if everybody's seen this Bruder film, there's the two handholds on the presidential limousine, and there's a reason why they're there. Because one or two agents, often two, were riding on the back of the car, and often in fast speeds, too. I brought up the fact that Robert Lilly, former agent of Kennedy's White House detail, told me that, oh, yeah, there was times we reached speeds of 50 or more miles an hour hanging on that back of that car. They did what they had to do. And again, I showed all these trips, foreign and domestic, and a lot of them recent, not just ancient history, but, you know, Kennedy and focusing on these crucial years of 61, 62, and 63. Then you're led to Dallas, and there's no agents in the back of the car other than Clint Hill briefly on Main Street, and that kills the whole idea that supposedly Kennedy ordered him off the car. Is everybody getting the impression now they blame it on Kennedy and it turned out to be Secret Service decisions? Kennedy had nothing to do with this. I played audio tapes of the actual former agents, they're all deceased now, telling me one after another, oh, I don't remember Kennedy ever saying anything about not having agents in the back of the car. If you look at newsreels, you'll see agents all there from time to time. And I think it really made a tremendous impression when people can hear these voices literally from the grave saying this. Because it's one thing for somebody to go up there in good faith and say, hey, these people told me such and such. But it makes a much more powerful presentation when you can actually hear the voices and so on. And again, see the photos and films. And that was a really important point. So far through the presentation, I think people were left with the fact, wow, Kennedy was a sitting duck. These are Secret Service decisions. And why were they blaming it on the president? It had nothing to do with all this. Then you get to the bubble top. Many people thought, oh, it was only on the car when it rained and Kennedy didn't want it. Well, I showed that actually he was on the car for a good third of all his motorcades, often in good weather conditions, shows him the motorcades, all his previous stops. He's smiling, ear-to-ear grin, and it's hot outside. There's no rain conditions. In fact, I just mentioned Robert Lilly. He mentioned a trip they went to Puerto Rico. Him and Roy Kellerman riding on the back of the car going 50 miles an hour, and it was bright, sunshiny day. The bubble top's on. They're both hanging on the limousine for protection purposes. And I brought up the point that Sam Kinney, the driver of the fob car, was adamant to me, very adamant, that he, meaning Sam, was solely responsible for the bubble top's removal. He told me that Kennedy had nothing to do with it. Kenny O'Donnell had nothing to do with it. No other agent had anything to do with it. He was solely responsible. He says he's lived with that at the time I spoke to him, was the early 90s. He said he'd have to live with that 30 plus years if he made the right decision or not. Now, the one thing I didn't broach with Sam, because quite frankly, it was the early 90s. I didn't think of certain things. Hindsight's 20/20, because he's a heck of a nice guy and very open with me. Is that it's a shame they didn't use the partial configuration, because of all the times the bubble top was on, that was the most common, and I'll just tell people what that is. The full bubble top speaks for itself. All the pieces are on the car. Well, oftentimes what Kennedy would do is a tremendous compromise. He would have the rear piece on and the front piece on, but the middle piece would be open, so maybe get a little air, intermittently stand. And if that configuration would have been on the car, many of the agents I spoke to told me that the bubble top definitely was a deterrent. It would have deflected a bullet. It would have shielded an assassin via the sun's glare, the metal stirrups and whatnot. And also just the fact that many people assumed it was bubble top, it was bulletproof. Even though it was not bulletproof in the traditional sense, many people assumed that. So they wanted to keep that assumption going with the public. They loved the fact that everyone was fooled and thought it was, you know, bulletproof. So again, you got to ask yourself, if that bubble top was on, would an assassin have even tried? The whole thing would have been aborted. And that's more, I want to give Sam Kinney the benefit of the doubt and say it wasn't something sinister, because he was so open to me on three occasions and I was a total stranger at the phone at the time. I mean, he took full responsibility for it when he had the opportunity to blame Kennedy, because official history blames him. I would just say it was an option not explored rather than something sinister. But it does show, again, I think people were left with the impression like, wow, I always assumed Kenny O'Donnell ordered it off, or Kennedy didn't want the bubble top. What's all these trips in New York and Chicago? And there's the bubble top. He's smiling. Oh, my God. And that's what some ladies told me afterwards. Wow, Vince, I always thought Kennedy didn't want the bubble top. Those pictures alone, he didn't have to play me that interview. Now I know that, you know, there was a precedent. But see, the thing is, Len, And for all you listeners, like I said before, a lot of these photos and films didn't become available for the last 7 to 10 years. So it really was a guessing game for decades whether a lot of this was true or not. Because we have plenty of footage in Dallas and plenty of footage of his inaugural. But in between was very hard to find. It literally took me decades to find some things. And to be fair, a lot of it came out the last 7 to 10 years. But the point is, it takes someone like little old me to show these and show the contrast. Otherwise, if you're not digging for these things, you're not going to see them. So that's that. I think this arguably made the biggest impression, but it's up to the audience to decide. They all were pretty much impressive, all the parts, if I do say it myself, was that people did not realize this. The building rooftops were normally guarded before the assassination. Many people thought, oh, that was only a result of the assassination, right? They knew to never let another Oswald or another conspiracy happen, so they manned multi-story buildings. And like I found out, no, I showed articles from the FDR, Truman, and Eisenhower era, and all throughout the Kennedy administration, local police officials in Milwaukee and Nashville and so on and so forth were saying, yeah, we had the police the tops of rooftops in Pittsburgh, my hometown. Oh, yeah, we had sharpshooters on the buildings, and if anybody would open a window, that would have been their last move. And we had men in the cars. I'll get to that in a second, about also monitoring buildings. So when people saw these articles, and a lot of them from 1963 especially, but going back to the FDR, they said, wow. So you mean to tell me, even if there's people in the vast minority who thought Oswald did it, oh, my God, if they would have been guarding the building rooftops with armed men, the assassination would have been aborted. Would Oswald have dared have fired? And obviously would have killed a conspiracy, because abort, abort, there's the men on the rooftops. I submit that the reason why the assassination was a go in this time, and possibly, a couple other times were dry runs, was because the security was lessened. And, as we've spoken before, Len, not that he needs corroboration, but Fletcher Prouty for years was out there espousing these things, and some people, being skeptical and, said, oh, how do we know? All due respect, that's this Colonel Fletcher Prouty saying it. And I totally corroborate everything he had to say and then some. I mean, foreign and domestic trips, multi-story buildings. And even, for example, the Florida trip 4 days before was John F. Kennedy's longest domestic motorcade. It was 28 miles long, and yet they had agents on the back of the car. They were going at a fast speed. The flatbed trucks were in front. Motorcycles were all around the car. And I got this from documents, and I also got this from human testimony. Some of the motorcycle outriders told me, oh, every multi-story building had armed guards. Oh, yeah, that's how they did. And Russell Groover, the lead motorcycle officer in Tampa, I'm like the only one to ever speak to him, he told me, well, how he did it was single ranch dwellings. Well, those were monitored by police on the ground, and he even had military police in somewhere. So they were at eye level, so it was all good. When they got to two stories and up, those were guarded by multi-story, by guards in multi-story building windows and rooftops and whatnot. So that's the reason why President Kennedy and all the other prior presidents under Secret Service protection lived. It wasn't luck. It wasn't fluky. It wasn't rubbing a rabbit's foot. They did these things, and obviously I always end a little part of my presentation on the topic showing Dallas, the wide open windows and the building rooftops not guarded. And again, that's what I offer to people, that President Kennedy should have lived. It's the title of my presentation was, what's your theory? Here's my fact. President Kennedy should have survived Dallas. And I think I made quite an impression there. And then I got into some other things about how normally a military officer was in front of the limousine taking notes. It was either Ted Clifton or Godfrey McHugh. And Godfrey McHugh said he was asked for the very first time by the Secret Service not to ride in the presidential limousine between the driver and the agent in charge by the Secret Service. He was asked for the very first time because they wanted to accentuate full exposure. Well, obviously that got, McHugh and Clifton out of harm's way, one less witness, and obviously made Kennedy more of a sitting duck. Less people in harm's way and also more of an open target, less people to protect. Maybe if Clifton's there, the ballistics is all screwed up because he took a bullet or was killed, or he was able to do something the agents didn't do and jump back and cover. He adored Kennedy, would have died for him, literally. He really was amazing, his loyalty. He's out of the way. And these were all Secret Service decisions. You have to ask yourself, where does coincidence end and conspiracy begin? Just a man in a building shoots a man in a car and his security's weakened. So I could live if they would have had all the security and somehow, some way he got through and just was meant to be, fate intervened. But when you couple it with the fact that, my God, you have an assassin adamantly denying he did it, Oswald. I don't even think he was on the sixth floor. We'll get into that in a moment. But then you get into all these security deficiencies, and they are blamed on Kennedy, but they originate from the Secret Service. That's what's incredible to me. And then you get into my suspects. And I told people that, you know, I have names. It's not like, you know, all due respect, ghosts on the grassy knoll. You know, I laid out my three suspects as I've done in the past. They are Floyd Boring. He was the number two agent of the Kennedy detail. The number one agent, Gerald Bain, B-E-H-N, took his first full vacation, which corresponded to Kennedy's trip to Florida 4 days before and the Texas trip. All during the Kennedy administration, he never took any time off. He just worked, other than the obligatory day here and there, but never interfered with a trip. This was his first trip that he was on a vacation for, and two back-to-back, and allowed Floyd Boring, and through documents that I discovered in the 90s and onward, I discovered it. Wow, and I showed people the audience. See, they got to see all these things and hear all these things. That Floyd Boring admitted three times that, oh, yeah, I was in charge of all the advance work. Oh, yeah, whenever President Kennedy made any kind of trip, I did all the advance work. I gave out assignments. I assigned advance agents. Winston Lawson testified to the Warren Commission and the House Select Committee. He had many conversations back and forth with Floyd Boring. So that's the number one guy, the planner of the Texas trip from the Secret Service standpoint, Floyd Boring. The buck stops with him. And then to add insult to injury, Floyd Boring, the good news is he adamantly denied to me, like so many of his other colleagues, he said, oh, President Kennedy never ordered us to do anything. He never ordered us off the back of the car. Very nice man, never interfered with our actions at all. You might say to yourself, well, that's good, Vince. Why is he a suspect? Well, because Clint Hill and other people said the exact opposite, but back in 4 days before, actually 3 days before the assassination, November 19th, he was going around telling his fellow agents, oh, President Kennedy doesn't want you on the limousine, doesn't want you on the limousine. Clint Hill, in his report he submitted to the Warren Commission, he twice says he can't remember who the agent was who told him not to ride the rear of the car, but for some bizarre reason under oath, he then admits it. And he says it was Floyd Boring. He was in charge of the Florida trip. And he told me between November 19th and November 21st, note the time frame, not to ride the back of the car. And he said President Kennedy didn't want us on there. Now, in 1963, 1964, and beyond, a lot of people would take that face value and say, oh, okay, well, you know, the president wanted him there. It's convenient he's not around to defend himself. But, you know, come from the Secret Service. And here's the other big discovery. I'm leading right into it before I get to my other two suspects. Many people think, well, the president's the boss. He's the commander-in-chief, the leader of the free world. This little pipsqueak agent. I mean, come on, Vince. He's like a servant. Dead wrong, and I showed much documentation to prove this. Just like Kennedy never warned the agents to do anything, I debunked that, and that was a Secret Service decision. Well, it turns out presidents, whether they're Kennedy, Truman, Trump, anybody, cannot order the Secret Service. The Secret Service, quoting President Truman, was the only boss the Secret Service had. Lyndon Johnson, in a speech of the Secret Service, confirmed this fact in 1968. President Clinton, when he dedicated the Secret Service building, he also confirmed this fact. He said, I hate to admit it, but it's true. They are the only boss that we have. And by law, and again, I showed this many screens of books and documents and testimony showing that, oh, every school, Mike Riley, the head of FDR's details, says, oh, any schoolboy will tell you that the head of the White House detail would order a president to do such and such and not do this and that. And what really blew people away was, it's like about 5 days before Dallas, Associated Press story, and it was little old me discovered it, like a lot of these other things, said the president or the Secret Service can overrule even the president when it comes to his own security. So this leads me up to another thing. Clint Hill must have come clean in 2010. He gave a sixth-floor museum oral history, and he said, well, the president can tell you to do certain things, but that doesn't mean you have to do it. What we would do is we'd listen to the president. We'd do what we felt was best anyway. And I played that a couple times with people because people were like, what? And I played it again. Yep, he said this, and it's on video. I was like, was this for posterity? So that comes from Clint Hill's own words, but we have all the documentation to back it up. So for listeners out there, what that says is even if Kennedy wanted to order them around, they were going to do what they were going to do anyway, according to Clint Hill. And so this specious and suspicious argument that Kennedy ordered them off the car and that's why they acquiesced is debunked, and also is debunked by the fact that Clint Hill rode briefly on the back of the car on Main Street. These were Secret Service decisions not to be there. In fact, Clint Hill, the reason why he was broke up for years, cried on 60 Minutes, is, if only I would have been there. I should have been there. I should have been on the back of the car. He cried about it from 1975 to like the early millennium. Then everything changed. And we'll get to that in a moment. But that was that. Second suspect is Emory Roberts. Emory Roberts was the shift leader. He was the agent in charge of the agents of the fall car, a few feet beyond Kennedy's car. And what he did was incredible. He ordered three agents, actually, you can argue all the agents in the FOB car and a few others, away from the limousine. I discovered this. A lot of people have probably seen this on YouTube and whatnot. I showed this on The Men Who Killed Kennedy. There's WFAA, ABC video of an agent running beside the limousine. Turned out that agent's Don Lawton. And another agent stands up in the FOB car and waves him back, and three times the agent, Don Lawton, raises his arms in disgust in the universal what gives. What's up? What's up with that? Maybe even an expletive, I won't say, but you get the impression. That was Emery Roberts. Another agent, Henry Ribka. I used to get confused these two. I didn't find it until several years ago. There was actually two agents, not just one. I used to morph them together, but actually Henry Ribka was also recalled by Emery Roberts. He admitted in his report he was running beside the limousine, and all of a sudden he disappears out of the newsreel footage. And it's only Don Lawton we see in the black and white classic video, which I showed on History Channel and on Coup and Camelot and other conferences. And this one was no exception. I showed the video again, and even in the audience, a lot of them had seen it before. It was still very dramatic in the context of my presentation to see Don Lawton raising his arms three times. And in 2013, he died in 2012, I believe. Well, in 2013, a woman friend of his who served in Army intelligence came out in a real obscure article in Idaho, I believe it was, and generated no response, found basically by mistake. And she said that, oh, Don had much regret. He even said for years, if only I would have been on the back of the car, I should have been on the back of the car. And it corroborates my discovery that he rode on the back of the car in Florida on that longest domestic motorcade I'd mentioned before. He was there in Tampa, and he was there in Chicago riding on the back of the car. There's documentation on that. So he assumed he was going to be doing what he did on the prior trips, and he was wondering why he was being called away, and that's why he threw his arms in the air. When I spoke to Don Lawton in 1995, unfortunately, I did not know he was the agent, but he did say something important to me. Importantly to me, he said, oh, who knows? You can hindsight yourself to death. If we only would have left guys in the back of the car – that's why we have regrets and remorse. Nothing about Kennedy wore us off the car. None of that stuff. He tells a total stranger on the phone, speaking to him for the first time, that who knows if we would have left guys in the back of the car. You can hindsight yourself to death, but he said, that's why we have regrets and remorse. Very telling. All these agents I spoke to on the phone through the mainly through the 90s, but into the millennium, had so many opportunities to lie to a stranger. Could have said, oh, yeah, that's the ticket. Yeah, President Kennedy didn't want us there. Yeah, you know, he had a rendezvous with death, you know, his poem. But they're all telling strangers, oh, that's baloney. Oh, that's hogwash. Oh, that's stupid. No, President Kennedy never wore us off the car. He had nothing to do with that. So it's very telling. And then I'll get to my third suspect, but I'll get to this matter in a moment. But my third suspect is Bill Greer. Bill Greer was the driver of the limousine. While he definitely did not shoot President Kennedy, what he did do was he allowed the triggers to have success and find their marks. And what he did was the shooting began. He slowed the car down. He looked back at Kennedy. He denied ever seeing Kennedy under oath to the Warren Commission, for that matter, to the House Select Committee. He said he only saw Connally. Roy Kellerman tells him, get out of line, we've been hit. While Roy Kellerman's grabbing the radio microphone, he's not doing anything either, Bill Greer turns around for a second time and is staring at Kennedy until Kennedy's fatally hit in the head. Only then does he face forward. Only then does he hit the gas. Kenny O'Donnell and Dave Powers on video, I showed this at the conference, admitted that if Greer would hit the gas, Kennedy lives. And Bill Greer was very remorseful that day. He was interviewed at length by William Manchester, and Jacqueline Kennedy was also interviewed by William Manchester. They both said that Bill Greer was very remorseful, said, oh, Mrs. Kennedy, I'm sorry. If only I would have seen it in time. If only I would have hit the gas. If only I would have swerved. But guess what happened, Len? When he gets the autopsy that night with the two FBI agents, when they interview him, he changes his tune. He says, well, sometimes the president asked us to slow down. No more remorse, and he's implicitly saying that, hey, Kennedy in the past order is to slow down, and giving the impression, I guess maybe that's what happened this time. Well, we can't leave Greer there. That in itself is pretty bad, but you could say, well, maybe that's gross negligence, Vince. Who knows? Maybe it was just very bad timing and whatnot. Well, Greer died in 1985. I got some new information, brand new off the press in a second about Greer, but wait to hear this. The first part is, I spoke to his son, Richard, 1991. Bill Greer's first wife died in 1969. Bill Greer remarried, and his wife just recently passed away. But Bill Greer only had one child, and it was Richard. And I asked him, said, sir, what did your father think of President Kennedy? Dead silence. Very awkward moment. So I stumbled over my words and got back into something to try to reel him back in. And we talked about trips and whatnot and Kennedy made. And I got back to him, sir, if you don't mind, could you tell me, what did President Kennedy, what did Bill Gurley think of President Kennedy? He said, well, we're Methodists and JFK was Catholic. What really hit home about that, you talk about a moment that froze me in time. Well, I did more research. It turns out Bill Greer was born and raised in County Tyrone, Ireland, only come to this country when he's between 18 and 19. And as listeners will know, for generations, for hundreds of years, Protestants and the Catholics have been fighting literally bloody wars over there, over the whole religious wars. So rather than just lying to a stranger, say, oh, yeah, he loved President Kennedy, President Kennedy loved him, or no comment, or just lied, he says, well, we're Methodists, and JFK was Catholic. Two postscripts on this was the Irish Times and another Ireland newspaper came forward in 2013 based on my book, but they did their own research and found out that, wow, Bill Greer's father, also named Richard, I guess that's where he named his son after, was part of the Orange Order. They were diehard Methodists. So those are the kind of people, sad to say, really wore it on their sleeves. They hated Catholics. So again, it really looms large in those few seconds. Here's Bill Greer that obviously felt that way because his son's telling a stranger, and those seconds ring out, and he doesn't take evasive action, and he lies about it. And before you can catch your breath, some brand new information, Len. This only discovered this literally last night. So this is the first time on the airwaves for this one. Well, again, I don't know if people know this or not. They've kind of probably figured this out by Facebook and whatnot. I have a tendency to, it's a little morbid, but I intermittently check all the living agents to see if some have passed away. And I find, Tim McIntyre passed away, and this agent from the motorcade passed away, and so on and so forth. So I checked out Bill Greer, and you might say, so I thought you said he died in 1985. Yes, I did, but I was curious about his widow because I knew she was still alive. Wow, she died in July of 2019. You might say to yourself, well, Vince, okay, what's that have to do anything? Her obituary says that she was in the National Security Agency from 1958 to 1973, and she joined the Navy during World War II in 1944. Bill Greer joined the Navy in World War II, also in 1944. Her first husband died at the young age of 40 in 1966, the same year that Bill Greer retired from the Secret Service. So all the millions, billions of people on this planet, Bill Greer chooses as his second wife this woman who was in the NSA when Kennedy was killed. And NSA is as spooky as the CIA in many respects, maybe more so. You could argue back and forth. But this was only known because the woman passed away and her family posted this on her obituary. That just, again, think about these people. Not only did his family have this, well, we're Methodist and JFK was Catholic thing, that his second wife joins the Navy the exact same year, 1944, and here's Bill Greer join the Navy at the same time, and she's in the NSA. Her husband dies at the age of 40, and she marries Bill Greer, and it just, the whole thing is like, wow. I mean, spouses have occupations and whatnot, but I didn't expect that. People said, wow, Vince, this is amazing. NSA, it's pretty strange, to put it mildly, so there's a little connection there. And one thing I'll backtrack about Emory Roberts, speaking of my other suspect, is he became extremely close to Lyndon Johnson afterwards. This is really fodder, grist for the mill for people that may think LBJ had something to do with it. Well, even before the shots rang out, he ordered the agents not to move. I didn't get into that. I should have gotten into that. In addition to the agents he recalled at Love Field, he also ordered the men not to move. And Sam Kinney, and this is on the Coup and Camelot, the DVD, I play the audio of it, and he says, Emory Roberts. He said, oh, yeah, exactly right. That's what Emory Roberts did. And I just couldn't believe my ears. Wow, why would an agent do that? Well, Emory Roberts, he became the appointment secretary for Lyndon Johnson. Again, there's documentation on it. This isn't theories. They're facts. It's based on newspaper articles where journalists were wondering, what's a Secret Service agent, active agent, assuming the position that Dave Powers used to do and taking questions from George Reedy, LBJ's press secretary. And the day after the assassination, there's a famous films and photos of LBJ leaving the executive office building. Everybody's dressed in black. Well, there's a gentleman holding an umbrella over LBJ's head. It's Emory Roberts. He's an active agent. He should be watching his pistol. He should be watching for potential assassins. Instead, he's doing something a steward would do, and he's holding an umbrella over his head. it's just incredible that, you know, there's the Umbrella Man, and less than 24 hours later, he was the new Umbrella Man, so to speak. But just the fact he – and I spoke to another agent who was more of a current agent. He said that, I've never heard of such a thing. That's incredible. And I showed him the documentation. He goes, I'm speechless, Vince. We're apolitical. We're not Democrats or Republicans. It doesn't matter if we like them or hate them. We're there to protect them. You're not supposed to be an active member of an administration while you're an active Secret Service agent. He was still a member of the Secret Service. He was also Lyndon Johnson's appointment secretary. So, again, this is grist for the mill for people that think, you know, the Secret Service has something to do with it, slash Lyndon Johnson. And that right there is, I would argue, a smoking gun. Forget about the stuff about Lyndon Johnson ducking during the shots and all this subjective stuff. Well, there you go. And it gets even deeper than that. One of the agents on the FOB car, Tim McIntyre, who, by the way, just passed away also in July. I have this on video. It came out in 1997 on ABC. He was one of four agents who was angry at President Kennedy for his private life. And I showed this during a presentation, too. And said, you know, prostitution is illegal. A procurement's illegal. And when you got a procurer of prostitutes praying in front of you, you got to ask yourself, well, what do they think of us? So he was talking about Kennedy in these derisive terms. Well, Tim McIntyre just joined the White House detail a few weeks before Dallas. And he's casting these aspersions on him at this late date. It makes you think, wow, when those shots were fired, is there another reason why Tim McIntyre didn't jump off the car and to try to protect the man? And then the whole thing about Clint Hill and his heroism, he was one of nine agents that drank the night before. You know, a lot of people didn't realize the scope and the depth of this drinking incident. And only nine agents drank the night before, but four of them rode in the FOB car, including the vaunted Clint Hill. And a few of them didn't leave the cellar or the Fort Worth Press Club until between 4 and 5 a.m. And they were to report for duty at 8 a.m. Now, a normal lay person only getting a couple hours sleep, assuming they even slept, is going to be haggard and out of it, and their reflexes are going to be terrible. Well, these guys live and breathe on their reflexes. They're there to protect the president, and they only had little or no sleep, a few hours of that, assuming they even went to sleep. So that's terrible in and of itself. You have sleep deprivation and alcohol consumption. Alcohol consumption is grounds for removal from the service, right from the Secret Service manual. The Warren Commission printed the page in Volume 18. Chief Riley confirmed this to Earl Warren under oath that, oh, yeah, it's grounds for removal. And then Chief Warren basically says, well, why didn't you take disciplinary steps? And Chief Riley wimped out. This would never fly today. But in 63, 64, did. He said, well, I didn't want to, you know, traumatize these agents and their families for future generations. Can you imagine if that happened today? Heads would roll. In fact, heads did roll then. In 2012, President Obama went to Cartagena, Colombia. He survived. In fact, he didn't even show up yet. And agents were fired for drinking and hanging out with prostitutes. And yet in 1963, agents were carousing with Jack Ruby strippers at the Cellar Club and at the Fort Worth Press Club drinking. They lost a president. And not only was nobody reprimanded, several of them were promoted. Clint Hill became the chief of the White House detail. He became assistant director. He retired early with a healthy government pension. He's viewed as a hero now. He has three books. His co-author is his girlfriend. That's all public domain. It's not TMZ material. It is what it is. And there you have it. And he's traveling around the country, him and Gerald Blaine, guys in their 80s, traveling the world, and they're still spotting this. President Kennedy orders up the car mantra and trying to convince people, massage people's minds that, hey, you know, we could have done what we could have done. It is what it is. You know, Kennedy didn't want us there. And Oswald, he did it. He was a fruitcake anyway. Get a life. But when you realize these men failed, and I think some of them failed on purpose, to quote Harry Truman, the buck stops. But the buck stops with the Secret Service. And finally, my presentation, what I did is I offered some tidbits that people didn't realize at large. Thomas Shipman was one of the White House drivers, full-fledged agent of the Kennedy detail. He died the month before at Camp David of an alleged heart attack. This did not come out until 20 years ago. A little more old me discovered it. It didn't appear online until like a year later. The former agents started to have a roll call of deceased agents. The only agent that died from the Kennedy days was good old Thomas Shipman. And it took years to ferret out information about him from family and whatnot. The family wants no remuneration, no publicity, no nothing. But they confirmed that they've been suspicious all these years about Thomas Shipman's death. He just passed his annual physical. He was a fit Secret Service agent. He goes to Camp David with a contingent of agents. President Kennedy's not even there. They're at Camp David, and he dies of a heart attack. And this, again, this is what his daughter told me. He said that, oh, yeah, we had family in Dallas, and Tom was looking forward to visiting family while he drove Kennedy on the Dallas trip as part of the Texas trip. And that left Bill Greer as the number one person, now with the death of Shipman, to drive Kennedy to his death through his inept driving and whatnot in Dallas. Shipman's death. And again, this is, again, it took little old me out there in the wilderness discovering these things. And how I discovered it, make it real quick, was George McNally, former Secret Service agent, became part of the White House Communication Agency, and he was on many trips from Truman through Kennedy, actually up to Johnson. And he wrote a book called A Million Miles of Presidents, but it was only published after his death by his widow, and it was only a Kinko FedEx deal. It was never published. She went to, like, FedEx and would make copies for people, Kinko's. And the Last Raw Bookshop had a copy of it, so I got it and said, this is very frustrating. There's no index. So it's fascinating. Then I get to a point, and it says, Agent Tom Shipman died suddenly. And in the context of the narrative, it's like, wow, this is before the Dallas trip. I can't believe this. No one ever, and I never heard of the agent's name before. And I looked at every book and document I could think of. Never heard of it. And all these experienced people said, I never heard of Tom Shipman in my life, Vince. This was 1999. And again, shooting through the year to find more corroboration. It took a long time to find his family members. And they said that, you know, it's a matter of taste. They don't know if they would all agree to it. The family would have to agree to it about exhuming his body, you know, like Zachary Taylor or whatnot, see if there's arsenic in the system. I don't know. At this late date, it could be done. The bottom line is, Len, he died October 14th, 1963. He was buried 2 days later. It was a country doctor verdict of heart attack, but no toxicology tests were run. This is a fit Secret Service agent who just passed an annual physical. His family's suspicious. He's buried quickly. And before you can catch your breath, guess who was involved in all this stuff about burying him quickly and so on and so forth? Dr. George Berkeley, the president's personal physician. And there is no word by President Kennedy, Pierce Salinger, any of the mainstream media about Thomas Shipman's death. The only thing that I could find, it took years to find these out. I only discovered these in 2013. There was some local Maryland small newspapers, not the Baltimore Sun, small local newspapers that mentioned his death, that he was a Secret Service agent, blah, blah, blah. But in mainstream media, nothing. And it was very bizarre that the president and the staff didn't mention his passing, because 10 years later, an agent died under Nixon, and he died in a helicopter crash. And oh my God, Nixon went on and on about him in a press conference. Pat Nixon and Jolie went to his funeral, and there was articles all about this. I even know the agent's name, Cliff Dietrich, was splashing all the newspapers. Very well known that this gentleman died 10 years later. He had 10 years before, an agent dies under very mysterious circumstances. Nothing said by the president or staff. It's just very, very bizarre. And by the way, there's a postscript about this article I found in 2013. It was only through newspapers.com, and I had to pay a fee. No Google search, no nothing. If you did that, you wouldn't find anything. It was only until I did that I discovered, like, wow, Towson, Maryland, these suburbs of Baltimore, did mention his death in passing. A little article saying he died, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, there you go. So I guess one thing, a final thing I'll say in the interest of time is that another thing I might have mentioned is the previous presentation. I don't know, but this is in my fourth book that, again, these are late discoveries in the last couple of years. Everybody knows that, you know, Camp Pendleton, San Diego, that's where Oswald was stationed briefly in the Marines. And the very same Marine unit in Camp Pendleton, San Diego, only discovered this a couple of years ago, Secret Service agent Chuck Saborl, who rode on the back of the car in Tampa. So that's a heck of a coincidence that they served in the Marines together. Unfortunately, Chuck Saborl also just passed away in July. July was a bad month for people passing away. A couple other agents passed away during that time of ostensibly old age. I don't think there's anything suspicious because they were in their like late 70s, early 80s. But the point being is he never said a word to anybody. He was one of the agents who spoke to Gerald Blaine of the Kennedy Detail fame. Never mentioned it. Hey, it's a quirk of fate. I served in the Marines of Oswald Camp Pendleton. I mean, to the exact – I got this in my book. And I presented – Len, it's to the exact unit and everything. So it's all like, oh, come on, Vince. That's just a coincidence. Maybe there was hundreds of people there. No, same everything. So I find it very hard to believe that he didn't have a yearbook, he didn't put two and two together, he didn't mention it to anybody. And again, a little old me has to discover it totally by a fluke. I did a search one time, and all of a sudden it just came about Oswald's Marine unit. I'm like, why is Chuck Saborl coming up in this search? And someone briefly posted, I think it was discovered by John Armstrong, one of his Marine unit roll calls. And that's how I discovered Charles T. Saborl and Lee H. Oswald. And there you go. So yeah, needless to say, when it was all done, Len, well, I received a really nice award, which I deeply appreciated by the publisher and everybody who was part of the conference. But the response I got was basically, a lot of people were like, wow, Vince, I never really paid it. It's funny at this late date. So many people ignore the Secret Service. They focus on Hoover's FBI, the CIA, the mafia. But the Secret Service is still, it's an uphill battle to get people to look at them. Because I think people just initially think, oh, they're the good guys. We're there to protect them. Oh, Clint Hill and blah, blah, blah. And they don't realize the assassination isn't going to be successful without their help, either directly or indirectly. So, yeah. So that's a long-winded way of saying it was very successful. And Len, in my remaining time, if you want, I can go through a little more of the conference in general if you want. You know.
Sure. No, we don't have a time constraint. I just have a couple of comments I want to mention here.
Sure, go ahead.
One is, you know, in a rare interview that you can find on YouTube of Vladimir Putin when questioned about politics, he said, well, listen, your security services had President JFK removed. So, I mean, he was talking about Trump should maybe be more worried because he said that. And right away, the interviewer said, let's change topic, right? But
wow,
that was amazing to hear Putin say that. And his quote was security services. Now, when I hear you talk about the bubble top and if we only did this and we only did that, to me, that makes it look like you're putting a blindfold on a guy in a firing squad. Like this guy, President Kennedy, was ordered to be shot. And here is the Secret Service in charge of that.
Yes.
In charge of making it happen. Now, I have a feeling that there was more other agencies in there. I have a feeling that, you know, among Alan Dulles and agency people.
I agree.
And Stale, that they were all working together. And I fall back on a quote that when I asked Fletcher Prouty, I said, how many people, when you got back to the Pentagon, how many people really knew what happened? And he said, they all knew. Right?
Wow. So yeah.
If only when I hear you say this, it seems to me like a real fraud that ought to be, no, you know, it doesn't matter if you sped up or slowed down. The guy might have stopped. I mean, there was other people who, I won't get into the Fetzer kind of thing, but they think that the limousine stopped, shots happened, and then they drove away.
Well, at the very least, Len, at the very least, what Fetzer's doing, what other people do, is they quote from my list that originated in 1991, and I've expounded on it in my books, that there's roughly 60 witnesses, of Dealey Plaza witnesses, including the Connollys and Jacqueline Kennedy, and Kenny O'Donnell and Dave Powers, said the limousine slowed or stopped. And a lot of people just take it, oh, they said the limousine stopped. No, no, no. Several said it stopped, but more of them said it slowed. And it slowed so much it appeared to be a stop, but it didn't actually stop like 100%. It's like if you ever see like a car backing slowly out of a parking space, and maybe it looks like it stopped for a second, but it never really stopped moving. That's the impression. So I've always corrected people on that, and I agree with you, man. It was more of a slowdown. It was a stop. It was still a fatal slowdown. It went against common sense and Secret Service regulations because they're supposed to speed up. In fact, not only with his own eyes and ears and training, and he was properly trained, the House Select Committee confirmed during testimony of Inspector Thomas Kelly and others that, oh, yeah, all the agents were properly trained, including the driver. Well, he was also supposed to act under the orders of the agent in charge, in this case was Roy Kellerman. Now, Roy Kellerman was a third stringer in place of Bain and Boring, but he did tell him, get out of line, we've been hit. And Kellerman, I've said this for years, Kellerman, to his credit, he told William Manchester, it's buried in a footnote, he says, Greer then looked in the back of the car. Maybe he didn't believe me. Wow. So even Kellerman was like, well, yeah, Greer then looked in the back of the car, maybe he didn't believe me. Jacqueline Kennedy, for her own, said, get yourself a good driver so nothing ever happens to you. And then she also told Mary Gallagher, boy, one of the agents might as well have been Maude Shaw. It turned out from other corroborations, Maude Shaw, the children's nanny, old nanny, she was referring to Bill Greer. So even Jacqueline harbored animosity, bitterness. But then again, see, there's always two sides. And some people say, well, Vince, what about that nice letter Jacqueline Kennedy wrote to Bill Greer saying, thanking you for service to JFK? I hearken that to, well, if you listen, if you look at the correspondence between Bobby Kennedy and Hoover, they look like they loved each other, but they hated each other's guts. That's for public consumption. That's like if you hate your boss, but you can tell them you hate your boss. You want to lose your job? So it's not a lot of people lie and fake and, oh, yeah, you're a great guy. What I really think about you. Well, it's for public consumption. But if you look at the correspondence, amazing book, and showed all that correspondence, you'd say, dang, like they like each other. They hate each other's guts, and no one disputes that. That's what it was, Jacqueline Kennedy. She was more being nice. Maybe she didn't want to traumatize him and have Jackie Kennedy was not mean-spirited. She's not going to send him a letter, because of you, my husband died. I mean, that was definitely not her. Especially 1963-64 etiquette. What's she going to do? sent a little note, you know, well, I'm not going to traumatize him and his family, married to the kid. Okay, you know, thank you for your service. Even though you're messed up, probably thinking, because what she told Mary Gallagher. So that's what people always get to see. There's always a little shade of gray here. And that's why when people say, Vince, boy, it's incredible. All those agents told you something directly against official history. I wonder why. Well, I always tell people it's easier to tell the truth than to lie. It was all these decades later. They're comfortably retired. They're no longer agents. They're John Q citizens collecting their pensions. It's all over with. Kennedy's dead. Oh, just some young whippersnapper. This isn't going anywhere. And to be fair, now keep in mind, when I was interviewing the vast majority of these agents, I was only in my 20s. I did not have a book out yet. I wasn't a journalist. So I probably didn't feel like there was any harm in just telling the truth. That's the only theory I have on it, Len, is that I guess that's what it was. It was like, why lie about it now? You know, it is what it is. And, but when you contrast it with the propaganda they were spouting at the time, it's a sharp 180 degree. I mean, Gerald Baines, the head of the White House detail, told me, I don't remember Kennedy ever saying anything about not having agents on the back of a car. If you look at the newsreels, you'll see agents on there from time to time. I almost dropped the phone. That, to me, is like when David Lipton talks about the Seibert and O'Neill report. When he saw surgery of the head area, just changed his whole outlook on the case. When Gerald Bain told me that, up to that time, I actually believed some of the pablum. Hey, why would I think otherwise? I was in my 20s. I read Manchester and Bishop, and it looked like Kennedy didn't want him on the car. It sounds plausible to me. And he says this, and I go, oh, my God, I can't believe it. But then after I recovered, I said, you know what, as incredible as it is, and thank God I had it on audio tape, played it at the conference. Someone could say, well, if it's one guy hang out in the breeze. He sounded very lucid, but come on, man, you need corroboration. He was the number one agent. I'll concede that that was not some private. He was there, and he would know. If you know, anybody would know, he would. Well, again, Len, all different parts of the country, all independent of each other. A lot of this was before the internet. No one's comparing notes. They're all just telling me, stranger on the phone. It'd be like cold calling and, hey, tell me your nationality, blah, blah, blah. Well, I'm Caucasian. I'm this age. I'm that. So it's like I'm telling, hey, true, President Kennedy, order you off the car. All these agents had a chance to rain on my parade. It wasn't like, Vince, some did tell you that, huh? Nope. They all said the opposite. Oh, President Kennedy's baloney. Where'd you read that? Oh, don't read Bishop of Manchester. Oh, that's bull. No, he didn't do anything like that at all. Whatever you guys want is the way it will be. They said he was really laid back. And, you know, and again, Clint Hill, interestingly enough, and it's on video and I showed it at the conference, he said, well, he can tell you what he wants done, but that doesn't mean you have to do it. What we always used to do with President Kennedy is listen to him and then do what we felt was best anyway. And that was a real – I had to play that clip again for some people because they were like, Vince, play it again. My pleasure. There it is. And I even had it transcribed. You could hear him perfect, but just for any – you know, he needed a transcript. And there it was. And I told people, I think the reason why he did that, a little bit of something for posterity. So people go looking back and, damn, guess Clint Hill was laying it out for people. Because, you know, even in early interviews after the Kennedy detail came out, Clint Hill did say stuff to the effect, well – you know, Jerry Blaine, the author of the Kennedy deal, you know, he claims, you know, President Kennedy didn't want them on the back of the car. And then all of a sudden it morphed into, he didn't tell her. He told us to be off the back of the car. But then when you listen to it, it all originated from Floyd Boring. He never heard President Kennedy say this. And so when you have Floyd Boring on tape, as by the way, and also in writing, telling me, oh, no, President Kennedy never wore us off the car. And this was in the early 90s before Gerald Blaine's book was even a thought, before my book was even a thought. You got to tell yourself, this is the truth. It's an avalanche of truth. It's not even like, you know, people throw out the Parkland doctors and nurses and Bethesda people, but there are a few people that ran on the parade. The majority of people said the back of their head was gone. But there's a couple stragglers that make it sound like it was on the side and a little bit to the front, you know, like Ken Salyer or not, but still the majority. Len, this is a landslide. Nobody rained on my parade. They all said the same thing. And he always threw in that, like, that's baloney. Oh, he wouldn't do that. And if you look at President Kennedy, his demeanor, and I've studied him for decades now, the last thing on his mind with a bad back and thinking about, you know, his speech and what he's going to say at a stop, an event, and his wife and blah, blah, blah. I wonder if Harry's on the back of the car. Like another agent told me, presidents have a lot more to think about than that. But the $64 million question is, well, why did they blame him after the fact? Why indeed? So they could be off the hook. And they were off the hook for decades till I came along. Other than a couple little exceptions here and there. Most people just viewed it as, oh, it was negligence, Greer slowed down. They could have done more, but that's it. And no one ever at the end of the day said, eh, on the other hand, I can't say these guys were evil. Look at Clint Hill. And oh, he suffered. Yeah, he's suffering all the way to the bank now. He's not crying now. He drove in a open convertible for the 50th anniversary, smiling his head off down Elm Street. You think the guy would have PTSD? He was smiling, laughing. He's making hundreds of thousands of dollars on his three major books. He's on the biggest book company in the world. Every book has sold hundreds of thousands of copies worldwide. You do the math. And then, Len, wait till you hear this. There's a proposal of his book, Mrs. Kennedy and Me, being made into a major Hollywood movie. So the money doesn't stop. And I'm sure there's going to be a scene in the movie blaming Kennedy for the assassination. You know, that's coming. So that's why this is still a current event to me. You still got a couple old men out there casting aspersions on Kennedy's memory. First, they killed him. Then they try to say, you know, he was a womanizer. Maybe it was good he was killed. He was a bastard in that respect. And some of the agents held him in contempt. Well, then you also this other thing. Well, he had a rendezvous with death. Meantime, we all have a rendezvous with death. Is everyone going to live forever? Hello? So they cast this big thing about his rendezvous with death poem. Come on, give me a break. But they try to make it sound like, well, Kennedy was fatalistic and reckless with his security. It's all bull. Total bull. And I think my presentation really cemented that for a lot of people. So, yeah.
All right. Well, you mentioned books. For people who are new to you as an author, where can they get your books? Do you want to mention them by titles?
Yes. Thanks a lot, Len. Appreciate it. Yeah. Yeah, briefly, the first one's called Survivor's Guilt, subtitle. It's Survivor's Guilt, The Secret Service, and the Failure to Protect President Kennedy. You can get all my books on Amazon. They're available on Kindle and paperback. Second one's JFK from Parkland to Bethesda. That's on the medical evidence. Third one's The Not-So-Secret Service, Agency Tales from FDR to Reagan. So it was mostly about JFK, but actually touched on some other presidents. And the fourth and maybe final one, we'll see how it goes if I give me more inspiration. The latest one came out last year, is Who's Who in the Secret Service. And that covers from McKinley up to Trump. It's 100, it's subjective, but it's 100 most famous, infamous agents, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Obviously, by default, a lot of Kennedy detail era agents, but also agents that, again, protected McKinley, Coolidge, Harding, FDR, et cetera, Reagan assassin attempt agents. And I go through what was good about them, what was bad about them. It's, again, the good, the bad, the ugly. And, yeah, so there you have it. I guess the final thing would be a coup in Camelot. I recommend that. I'm on there for about 15 minutes, DVD, Blu-ray, but it's also really good for some of the other presentations too. Sherry Feister's on there, Doug Horn, Barry Ernst, Dick Russell, Jerry Dealey. Really good stuff, yeah.
Okay, good. You mentioned that there were some other people that gave a good presentation that you want to talk about and help promote. What were some of the other highlights of the conference?
Oh, okay. Yeah, there was many. I mean, I didn't attend the whole conference because, you know, obviously got to sleep and eat and do some other things, go to the plaza. But I will say I attended a vast majority of this one, and I was very impressed. I'm going to just tell you flat out, I think this one blew away the one 3 years ago. I was at the Trine Day / Judith one in 2016, and it was good. It was okay. This one was much better. Just much better. The quality of speakers and what they had to present. One of them was Christopher Fulton, the author of The Inheritance, his latest blockbuster book. Really good. Robert Tannenbaum from the Haas Select Committee was there. Gave a lengthy presentation. Very inspiring. The man should, well, he already was the mayor of, what was that, out in California. I forget right now. It eludes me, but he was.
Beverly Hills?
Beverly Hills, thank you very much for the rescue there, Len. he should run for office again because he's an amazing speaker, really compelling stuff there. And he showed for the lay audience that people didn't know. It was kind of like Conspiracy. And I mean this with all due respect to him. Don't take this the wrong way. There's those books in his Conspiracy for Dummies. He did a brilliant job of sussing it down to the basics of why there was a conspiracy. Brilliant stuff. Ed Tatro, who was also on The Men Who Killed Kennedy with me, although he was on part 9, I was on part 7, did a great overview of The Men Who Killed Kennedy series as well. And he also introduced some other speakers, did a really good job on that. Roger Craig Jr., the son lookalike of his dad, Roger Craig Sr., they both were deputy sheriffs, by the way. He was there with Steve Cameron. Steve Cameron, great guy, author of a tremendous book on Roger Craig. It's out now, and he's also, I think it's done or it's going to be done. It's a documentary on Roger Craig's life. They were both there. And did a tremendous presentation with Gary Shaw. So there's some tremendous speakers at Trine Day / Judas Conference. And if you missed it, you missed a lot. It's going to be on DVD, but some really powerful stuff. Robert Grodin was there. And, you know, he's the audiovisual master. He was the Haas Select Committee guy. He's in the plaza a lot of times, as people know. Well, he was there with his books and DVDs and presenting with Roger Craig Jr. and Gary Shaw. And he was just incredible. He was also an incredible presence there at the conference. It's like, you know, is what it is. He's one of our stars, one of our heroes, and another High Select Committee connection. You had author Gary Fannin, who's an author of a book, did a really nice presentation. And he was another one that was real, just like Tannenbaum, really embraces the basics of conspiracy. It's good because some people get on esoteric stuff, you know, and some theories are out there. Some theories are very good, but they're still like for the lay audience. Maybe some of the stuff's going over people's head. It's nice to have some people that just show, hey, this is the reason why we believe there was a conspiracy, and here we go. And did a really good job there. Chris Milligan, the president of Trine Day Books, did a great presentation on life as the publisher of banned books. And he talked about how he tried to get some of these books published and all the mainstream media laughed at him and publishers said, forget it. So he, with his own credit card, deep in debt, published his first one, barely got above board until a couple ones were very successful. Successful in a grassroots way, like still very successful, but not like, you know, Harry Potter successful, let's put it that way. But now he's published dozens and dozens and dozens, and now they're beyond just the JFK assassination. They're on other topics of political interest and intrigue and whatnot. And, you know, admittedly, was it Me and Lee by Judith Baker? That's one of his bestsellers. Also, Ed Haslam, his book was it on Dr. Mary's Monkey. That's a huge success for him. And I know HB Opera Belly had some bestsellers, the one on Frank Olson's death. That was a big bestseller. So Trine Day has really come up. They started out, I'd say, make a baseball analogy. They were like single A. I'd put them up to double A and maybe fighting for triple A baseball. They've come a long way. I even told Chris, boy, I go into bookstores and I see Trine Day books. A couple times I even saw my books. And there was a time that would have been laughable. All fans, you can only order those online or specialty books. Well, now every one of his books in Kindle, not just paperback. And again, I've seen them in mainstream books just walking in like, wow, look at Timbuktu. And I've had other people take photographs of my book. Fans, I'm in Oklahoma. Here's your book. I just walked into Barnes & Noble. It's here. Like, wow. So he's got a good outreach. That was him. The other one was amazing speaker, Don Ratliff. He was like the master of ceremonies. The guy's got to be a professional speaker. Great guy. He basically introduced a lot of people and gave out some of the awards and whatnot. I might have mentioned it before. Dr. Cyril Wecht, who spoke at both conferences. 88 going on, 48 as far as his mind. He is amazing. He's a little hunched over. God bless him when he stands. But he looks the same. And he is as sharp as a whip. This guy is a lawyer and a doctor, and wow, he just is so impressive. And he just says everything off the cuff, and he's amazing. He really, truly is. He was really very impressive and inspiring in the plaza. He was one of the speakers in the plaza. Oh, eyewitness Marianne Moorman. She was also at the Trine Day Judith ceremony in the plaza. It was amazing. She even got the microphone and said, I'm still here, everybody. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Everybody gave her a nice ovation. Real sweet lady. She's the one who took the famous Polaroid photo of the knoll. Buell Wesley Frazier was at the conference. Oswald Friend, who gave him a ride that morning, worked in the Texas School Book Depository, does not believe Oswald acted alone and thought the shots came from the grassy knoll. He was there. And also for years, didn't think the package was one that could have held a rifle and all that. But he was there. Was incredible. I got a picture with him, and I posted it on my blog. Hubert Clark was one of JFK's funeral honor guard. He was a witness, of course. He was there. He's also an author of a Trine Day book as well. Mal Hyman, author of Bearing the Lead. He was talking about all about the corruption of the mainstream media and how it manipulates public opinion, blaming only Oswald from the beginning to the present hour, talking about how the 50th anniversary of 2013 really was the mainstream media's way of saying, okay, get a life. Oswald did it. It's time to wrap this up. And that was their way. And also showing, sadly, public opinion polls used to be close to 60%, and they used to get up to like 80% between like 1988 to 2003. Sad to say, the latest opinion polls are back to like 61% believe there was a conspiracy. A lot of that has to do with mainstream media. Really, the tide has turned, and they're just like hammering the Oswald did it thing. It also has something to do with generational thing. People are more and more people are not of age when Kennedy was killed. And last but not least, it's also conspiracy is now a dirty word in some circles. And so, you know, I'm just going to say it. It's public domain. There's nothing to hide here. Jim Fetzer, as everybody knows, got into major trouble, court case that made international news. He owes the Sandy Hook father family $500,000 for saying Sandy Hook didn't happen. And all this 9/11 stuff that's polluted the JFK case. And what it does is it makes us look like tinfoil hat people. It does damage. So now when people think conspiracy, there's people go, oh, you conspiracy theorists, you tin hat people, they didn't ever used to say that before, especially during like the Oliver Stone movie came out. Some people might have said we were wing nuts, but most people thought we're very, I even said if the JFK movie came out now, you know, does very well on cable TV, it's still a classic. If it was made today, it had never been made before, I don't think it'd be as successful. You talk about the media being against it. You would, sad to say, you'd have a part of the public against it because of the Sandy Hook 9/11 crapola that's out there. It is what it is. It's done damage. But he also hoped for the future. He's talking about how there's younger people that are interested in the case. I saw a lot of young people in the plaza and amazing Matt Doughton, D-O-U-T-H-I-T. He is a very active researcher and an author coming out of the Book of Medical Evidence. I think he's like 24, if that. He is a savant on the medical evidence. He's also a very good friend of David Lifton, but he has his own views on the case. But he is amazing. He's like Rain Man when it comes to the assassination. So who's this young kid? I was born in 1966 after the assassination, and I guess I don't look my age, but everybody thinks I'm a kid. This kid is a kid, and he's into the assassination big time. So there's definitely hope, and that was one of the things Mal Hyman's presentation ended with, a lot of hope for the future. There was an all grim picture. You know, still a majority of people believe there's a conspiracy. And I also like to point, Len, for the record, a lot of this is American polls. If you go overseas, it's still a healthy 80% of people don't believe the Warren Commission. But it's America. It's been a little dumbed down due to, you know, attrition and giving conspiracy a bad name with Sandy Hook and 9/11 and whatnot. And that's more or less it. Yeah, Dick Russell, not to be confused with Dick Russell, the Warren Commission, the one who wrote The Man Who Knew Too Much. He was there. He's a Trine-Day author as far as he's written the introductions to certain books and whatnot. He was there, and he was really compelling. As everybody knows, he does, you know, Richard Case Nagel. That's his big thing. And just a very great presentation. There was no – and just for people who were wondering if this was Judith's conference – she was – there was no pictures of her anywhere, and she didn't speak before, during, or after my presentation or during a lot of other people. People were there, and you would never know. The banners didn't show her or her book, and the conference program didn't show her or her book. This was a JFK assassination conference that she happened to be involved in. It wasn't like past ones. Maybe her early ones were her, but it wasn't like it. So for anybody out there who has cast aspersions on her, she's a nice lady, and she did not – come across like, this is my conference. You really felt like it was more neutral. It was more of a Trine-Day conference just because the majority of the speakers were Trine-Day authors. So, yeah, that's about it. It was very good. Yeah.
Well, very interesting. Thank you for taking the time to talk about it and let people know how good it was and inspirational.
Sure.
Very good talk again. If people want to know more about your books, I suggest they pick up the last one. And, of course, you know, Survivor's Guilt, your first one then. Once again, just give out your website or blog.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, Len. Thank you for all your listeners, too. Yeah, the best way to do it would be just Google my name, Vince Palamara. It's P-A-L-A-M-A-R-A. And my two major books will come up in Amazon info and a whole bunch of my YouTube channel and that. So that just Google my name and, yeah, there you go.
Okay, good. We'll make links to that in the show notes.
Thanks so much.
Okay, before we wrap up then, is there anything at all that you wanted to bring up that I didn't mention, or you pretty well covered a lot of stuff? I usually give people an open mic to discuss, but is there anything else and any other topic or anything?
Yeah, I would just say, just very briefly, just to wrap this up, I would say not only was this conference very inspiring for me, it was very inspiring for everyone else I spoke to, and the reaction from everyone else, not just to my presentation, I mean to other presentations and other people too. And I think the torch has been passed. The torch is going to carry forward. I do not think it's at the end of the case or interest. If anything, it's going to continue. My answer is this is going to continue next year and beyond. It is what it is. People are still interested. They're still fascinated. It's still an open case. So, yeah, it might be getting up there, but people are still interested in this case. Yeah.
All right. Very good. Thank you, Vince. Email me anytime something is new and you want to come on Black Op Radio to discuss anything. Let me know.
Definitely.
Otherwise, I'll call you if your name pops up in the news.
Sounds great, man. Take care, Len. Thank you.
Right. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Good night.
Bye-bye.